So today we have a special episode for you. Patty and I teamed up with Lewis Teplis from Collectively to talk about the $5.5 billion Visa settlement. And so I want to take just a minute, Patty, before we dive into this one to talk about this. So first and foremost, this is an affiliate relationship sponsor for our podcast. I want to say that right off the bat. I also want to say that, as many have pointed out in our industry, and we talk about openly in the interview, your merchants can claim they're part of the settlement by taking something they got in the mail, filling it out for free, and sending it in. However, what I found is two things. Number one, usually merchants don't do that.
Right.
And the other thing is that if they do that, they usually don't get the full value of the settlement, because in these types of situations, they don't really know the right data to send in. In this case, it's a 14-year period of time covered by the settlement, which we're going to dive into. So Patty and I worked together with Collectively to put together a little affiliate program for you as the agents and ISOs. You can get signed up, go out there and get all of your merchants signed up to get their part of the settlement. And make some money in the process. And so that's what we're talking about today. Then I get into questions in the field. I talk about working smart versus working hard. And then Patty, tell us about the insiders today.
Talk about consumer spending and about some really good data that we've received lately showing consumer spending is up. Yes, inflation may be up, but consumer spending is doing quite well.
Indeed. Awesome. Well, with all that being said, this particular episode of the podcast is sponsored by Collectively. And so we're going to dive right into that right now.
Welcome to the Merchant Sales Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Patty and I are here today with Lewis Teplis, CEO at Collectively. How are you doing today, Lewis?
I'm doing great. Patty and James, I appreciate you guys actually taking the time and allowing me to come on your podcast. Thank you.
Well, I'm really enjoying this topic we're going to talk about. So this is something that's been floating around for a lot of years. So
yeah,
it's great to have an expert.
Yeah, I think 14 years to be exact, right? Or something like that, right?
At least.
So we're talking today about the $5.5 billion settlement that, you know, Visa and MasterCard went through. And we're going to talk about how we can help our merchants gain access to these funds that they are owed back. And we're also going to talk about how ISOs and agents can make a little money in the process by helping their merchants. So kind of a, you know, good and good. I love stuff where you can help others and be successful at the same time. So Lewis, with that being said, and before we dive into this topic though, I always like to hear your story. How did you get into this business that you're in, and what led you to take part in this whole settlement thing and helping merchants and all that?
So I'm a claims guy in all reality by accident and now by intention. And when I say by accident, it was about 10 years ago, I started helping a friend of mine who was in the securities class action claims filing business. And as I got started, the litigation with Visa and MasterCard went from litigation to settlement. So we dug in, we learned about the settlement and learned that 75% of all credit cards are processed in our backyard. I live in Atlanta. And we reached out to the likes of TSYS and Merrick Bank. And we actually at that time had signed them on as partners to introduce our service to their merchants. The case was appealed. It's now been appealed 4 times. And where
maybe
we
five's coming up.
Very quick win. We learned that there's nothing fast and quick about class action settlements. And we learned to file claims in many settlements. And along the way, we built a technology platform so that our clients could actually see what's available to them on a dashboard, answer some simple questions, and then allow us to do all the work.
And your clients being the ISOs and the acquirers?
So ISOs and acquirers, agents, they would be our partners, and they would introduce us to their merchants who are the eligible claimants.
Gotcha.
Any given
right.
Settlement.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's start with the basics here, Lewis. So talk to us about, you know, what were the claims of this particular class action? And what was the ruling and the settlement amount? Like, talk to us about kind of the high level of what we're talking about here, the settlement.
So I'll jump in a little bit. You probably saw a lot of news last week about
$30 billion,
right?
Right.
The initial case was filed in 2005. Allegedly, Visa and MasterCard colluded to inflate interchange fees or make sure they didn't drop below a certain percent. They decided to settle instead of actually going to trial. And the initial settlement was $7.25 billion. Over the course of time, many of the largest merchants opted out. Amazon, Walgreens, Home Depot, The airlines pulled their resources, opted out, and they've already settled privately. So that makes the $5.5 billion that's left, there's real value in it for small and medium merchants. And over the course of the last 10 years, the case has been appealed 4 times. It was actually split into 2 cases, business practices and monetary damages. Monetary damages is our focus, helping merchants try to recover the funds they're entitled to. And that news we saw last week about the $30 billion, that was the business practices portion of it. And I'm not going to dig into that ruling. That's probably best. Talk to your Visa or MasterCard rep about the changes they're going to make. But that $5.5 billion was actually approved last year. And the claims filing period opened last December. And the current deadline is May the 31st of 2024. So we've got a couple of months left to try to file claims on behalf of merchants.
So what is the what are the qualifications for a merchant that wants to get some money out of his deal?
So a merchant that accepted Visa and MasterCard from January 1, 2004 through January 25, 2019 would likely be an eligible claimant. And I say likely because if you use PayPal, PayPal's model, Stripe and Intuit have different models where they're PayFac or they have service fees versus interchange. They actually pay the interchange. Today, that's not part. Those merchants would not be eligible. That could change, though, because there is an argument with the courts today about the Intuit and Stripe model where Intuit's trying to accept or claim the recovery. And the judge is considering whether it should be those merchants or Intuit. So that's still under review.
And that would, I'm sorry, just to clarify, I mean, I hadn't thought about that. I mean, even for a lot of the agents in our industry that would use maybe a tiered pricing or flat rate type pricing model, are you saying that even in those cases, or are you just saying more of that PayFac where there's like the sub merchant accounts? Like what's the distinction?
So it's who actually pays the interchange fee, right? So if the merchant is actually paying that interchange fee, where in PayPal, they're charging you a service fee.
Right.
You know, and it's based PayPal's on the language. Yeah, the language in that merchant agreement, you know, with the PayFac and that language in the agreement, you know, every PayFac might have different language. One PayFac might actually be the eligible claimant and another might actually not. So
interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but the majority of merchants, you know, Stripe has grown over the years and Intuit has grown their business as well as PayPal, but the majority of merchants use other processors and likely be eligible, the eligible claimant.
So give us an example of how much money a merchant might be entitled to. I mean, we're talking about a very long period of time. It seems to me if I only did 100 transactions a year over the course of 14 years, that's a lot of transactions.
A lot of transactions, your volume, right? It's based on your interchange fees. So, you know, we like to say that a company that does on average $1 million a year, there are a number of variables. How long have you been in business?
Right.
You know, and how many claimants are actually going to file their claim? And then what was the risk of that merchant, right? So as you start, you know, your interchange, you're a high-risk merchant is paying a much higher interchange versus lower risk. So it would be my interchange fees for the entire class period. And I likely get back 2-3%. That number could grow if a lower number of merchants file. And what we know is that the court has some data was provided to the administrator hired by the court to oversee the administration of the settlement. What we have seen is a lot of that data is not very accurate. It's not great. Yes. So what our value is we try to help you maximize the value of your claim by increasing or finding that data for you.
So let me see if I can restate this before, because I want to talk about the agent and ISO side, but I want to make sure we all kind of understand the merchant side. So correct me if I'm wrong here in my you know short summary of this. So as I am understanding what you're saying, if I own a small business and I processed payments between 2010 and 2019, or what was
2004 and 2000. Oh yeah, yeah,
2004.
Right,
2004 and 2019. Okay, so during that period of time, I got to look at all the interchange that I paid. So not my total processing fees, but my total interchange fees that I paid over that whole period of time, which could be significant. Then I would look at that and I would say roughly 2 to 3% of that amount would be potentially something I could get back as a, you know, as a claimant, as a merchant. That's what I would be entitled to.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Then the question, you know, we have for our clients is, you know, one, how easy is it for us to get the data? Do they have any data if those data sets are hard, and the likelihood of somebody having data going back to 2004? So then we help model back for larger clients where data doesn't exist. But on a minimum, that 2 to 3%, we feel pretty comfortable it's going to fall in there. And we also think that, you know, there are many, many merchants that just won't file claims.
Right. Of course. Yeah.
Oh,
so,
true. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And so at the end of the day, though, that $5.5 billion is getting paid out. It's getting paid out based on the people who file. Is that what you're saying? So
correct.
If less people file, they're going to get more money.
It's going to be distributed pro rata. So
got it.
The more that file, the less you'll get. The less that file, the more you'll get. And we think it's probably going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, I think that 35% of all merchants mm-hmm. might file claims. That might even be high, but we think it'll be 65% of all interchange fees.
Right. Cause in other words, the larger merchants who paid a lot of interchange, they're going right. to make sure that they file.
A lot of them will. You know, we had a conversation with a group that had 90 hotels the other day, all big wow. hotels, big properties in major cities. And surprisingly,
they had no idea.
He'd never even heard. He wasn't even aware of the settlement.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think it's a good point too. It's an interesting opportunity, I think, to, you know, a lot of our listeners maybe are trying to get into maybe that next tier of merchant that's larger. This is an interesting way to
sure.
have that conversation, right? So I think that's really interesting.
We've always thought it was a business development opportunity to help clients file.
Yeah. Okay. So let's transition and talk about the ISO agent then. So for that ISO and agent, you know, why would they get involved in this? Talk a little bit about the kind of the financial impact. And of course, we just mentioned, of course, business development as well, but talk about the agent or ISO. Why should they get involved?
So one, it's a value add for their clients. Helping put money back into people's pocket is always a good thing to do. What we do is we try to make it easy. You know, we built a technology platform where we create the communication marketing assets, keep it simple for an ISO or an agent to email their clients and then drive them to collectively where they register. And then we do the rest of the work for them.
Okay.
We have a contingent fee based on whatever we collect. We keep a percentage of that. And then we'll do a revenue share back with our partners.
Okay. Got it.
Nice.
Yeah. So let's say that I'm an agent. I have a merchant that would like to participate in this. Walk me through the process. What, as an agent, like what do you mention that email? Like what do I do? What does this process actually look like for me and for my merchant?
So the first thing that agent does is they'll sign a partner agreement with us. We'll create their communication assets, create an email that they can send out. We'll edit it, put their logos and give them the brand equity. They'll email their clients and their client will literally click through and then register for collectively. And then we will do the rest of the work for them. We'll do as much as we can. If we,
right.
we'll let them know, you know, the data that we found, if there are missing years, we'll try to model back. We try to do whatever we can to maximize the value.
Could you, and I know this is going to vary a lot, but could you be a little more specific as far as this data you're talking about? So, I mean, obviously.
Yeah. I was wondering about that myself.
This merchant's got to prove that they paid interchange. I mean, like, how, you know, what's usually involved in that for these merchants? What do they have to do, or what do you guys have to do to make this happen?
So technically a merchant doesn't have to do anything except for register. They can file a claim on their own. They should have received a claim form in the mail from mm-hmm. the administrator. If they choose not to, they can outsource that to collectively. And we know that we can reach out to third parties and try to get data if we know who their old processors were, their merchant IDs, or their card acceptor ID. And then we know that some data has been provided to the court. Worst case scenario is we're dependent on the data that was provided to the court that we're able to pull in for them. And what we found is that data set is not complete.
Sure. Got it. But that's interesting though. So, but I mean, even if all I, so if I understand what you're saying, even if the only thing I was able to get my merchant to do is like go and register with you guys, right? And everything, you guys can then pull this data from the court, and the court would potentially already have some data from Visa or MasterCard or somebody to say, hey, here's what we show as a record or whatever of how much interchange they've paid. And then that would be used to figure out the amount of the settlement I would get as a merchant. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. That, so we'll be able to pull transactions and transaction volume by dollar and the interchange fees paid, but and we can break it down by year.
Okay, that's pretty cool actually. And so I get what you're saying, and then what you're saying is if they're missing some years in there maybe in that data or public data, then maybe you could go back and model and say, well, hey, were you still in business during these years and did you do about the same amount of revenue and volume? Okay, then you could kind of model that back. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we'll model back and we'll try to make a case why, you know, their claims should actually be valued higher.
Okay. Well, that's actually really cool. Okay. So one last question, which is always the interesting one with the, to me, with the settlements and the class actions and all that. Talk about timeline a little bit. I know this is always like a process, right? So what are these agents and ISOs telling their merchants in terms of like when they may actually get some money out of this?
So the deadline to file a claim and the only way to recover money in the settlement is a claim has to be filed. The current deadline is May the 31st. And then usually what happens once you get to a deadline in a settlement is the administrator will review all the claims that have come in. They'll audit them. You know, they'll audit our case for why a certain merchant should have a higher value claim. And in some cases, it's 12 to 18 months. In my opinion, this case, funds won't be dispersed for 2 years. Now, based on the size of a merchant, we actually have the ability to make an offer to buy their claim at a discount today versus that merchant having to wait 2 years. So we'll do that for some merchants.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, that's really
very cool.
Yeah, I got it. So again, I think that, you know, what I'm hearing you say is it's like, okay, if I had this book of business, I need to get all my merchants to fill out this little form. And hopefully there's some data out there and you guys can try to get some other, but then there's also this opportunity of, let me go after my largest merchants, maybe even in my local community, go out and actively prospect for really large merchants who might have 20, 50,000, $100,000 or whatever in this claim in value. And I really want to go hard after them and try to get them involved. And in those cases, if there's enough money at stake, you guys may even come in and say, hey, you've got $100,000 coming in 2 years, but we'll give you X now at a discount in order so you don't have to wait.
Right. Correct.
Wow.
But we always look at it as doing nothing is not an option.
Right.
Choose to file a claim on your own, or you can choose to outsource it, but doing nothing just isn't an option when you're getting technically free money back. Right.
Right.
I mean, the expense that came out of your pocket at some point in time, but whether it's $100 or $100,000, right. Doing nothing's not an option.
So just to clarify in my mind, so basically what you have is a platform that can take all these numbers and crunch them, bring in numbers from other sources, crunch it all together, and then come up with a magic formula?
So, well, what we do, we don't really come up with a magic formula on the amount.
Or a magic number, I guess is what I'm thinking.
We built a technology platform. So while the case was under appeal and we were learning the business of capital recovery is what we call it.
Sure.
We built Collectively, and within Collectively, we identify settlements, we match those settlements to specific industries, and then we make them available to users on their dashboard. So when you think about a restaurant, there's Visa, MasterCard. There have been 5 or 6 food settlements, chicken, beef, pork, salmon, turkey. There are electronic component settlements, CRT. You think about your laptop. It has a lithium ion battery. It used to have an LCD screen. It's got an optical disc drive. And hotels, you know, with the TVs they were purchasing, they're buying food for their customers. And then there's one in litigation. It's that fraud liability chip, the EMV chip.
Right.
We think, within the next couple of years, that's probably going to go to settlement. And those same merchants that had issues on premise, not online, will have an opportunity to get money back in that also.
Wow. Okay, so for anybody out there who's interested in learning more, they can visit ccsalespro.com/settlement. But I was wondering, before we let you go, Lewis, are there other resources that you or we could direct people to learn more about this? what's involved in not only what's involved in getting the merchant set up, but sort of even getting to that point.
So what we did for those users that would like to contact us is we created a page where they can literally go in and sign up, sign our referral partner agreement online, and we'll have their communication assets, landing page, emails, and things like that ready probably within a few days. Or they have the ability to request a call. And you know, we think that with the timeline where it is today, May 31st being the deadline.
Right.
We made it really simple for a partner, an agent or ISO, to come in and just sign up with Collectively today. And we'll be ready to help them launch their clients and introduce the recovery opportunity within a few days.
Excellent. Again, ccsalespro.com/settlement. And that'll take you to Lewis and his people and fill out the form. And
yeah.
Start making new sources of revenue.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, Lewis, I always enjoy doing these things because I get so many emails usually, like, you know, like 2 years from now, I'll get an avalanche of emails from agents that are like, hey, I can't believe it. I signed up for that thing and I just got paid this money and my merchants all got money. And, you know, so it's always a good thing, I feel like, when we can do things like this. And I think that, and, you know, you already brought it up earlier, and I want to make sure I clarify this as well, is like, your merchants absolutely got something in the mail. They could go fill that out and they could, you know, go and claim their portion. But I think at the end of the day, what I found is usually they end up leaving a lot of money on the table. And mm-hmm. and the other issue is they usually just don't do it. And so when we can go out there and actually say, hey, if you filed this yet, if you haven't, go here, it's really easy, sign up. To me, that's always a really good value add to the merchant, Lewis.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about the different companies that might be eligible claimants and they just don't realize it. A business that sold their hotel. Right. You might be a franchise, you know, a group that owns a bunch of different properties. You sold one in 2020. The likelihood is the language in that purchase and sale transaction has that claim. You still own the rights to that claim. And people, a lot of times, just don't even realize it. When we talked to the hotel group, they had 30 current properties. And they had sold 5 or 10 over the last few years. And one, they didn't even know about the settlement. And two, you know, we took 30 properties and we made it 40 just by having the simple conversation of, hey, let's figure out and make sure, have you closed any? Hey, you know, we've got a lot of club owners that during the pandemic shut their businesses down.
Sure.
And, you know, it's not even on their radar. They don't realize it because they're not active, and who knows where that claim form actually got mailed.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, good stuff. All right, so we'll give that link one more time. So it's ccsalespro.com/settlement. That's going to redirect you over to Collectively's website with a form you can fill out to kind of streamline the process of getting started and getting your merchants going. Lewis, I want to thank you so much for taking time to share this with our audience today. I'm sure many of them will be reaching out to you and getting more information about this. And hopefully we'll end up getting a lot of money back to small business owners and back to ISOs and agents.
Patty and James, thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for being here. It's been great.
Well, I sure hope you enjoyed this great interview that we just had. I want to take just a minute again to mention Collectively, since they're the sponsor of the podcast, and remind you about the URL if you haven't gone there yet. Head over to ccsalespro.com/settlement. ccsalespro.com/settlement. That'll take you to a page that Collectively put up specifically for ISOs and agents to be able to quickly get signed up and be able to offer the information to their merchant that we just discussed in the interview. So with that being said, let's dive into questions from the field.
This is Questions from the Field, brought to you by ccsalespro.com, the leader in merchant sales training and technology. And now, here is Questions from the Field with James Shepherd.
So, Patty, we've been kind of having different themes going on with the questions from the field. I was doing some objections and overcoming that. And then this week we have this episode I wanted to get in there real quick talking about the settlement because of that time constraint. So I want to have like a one-off topic that I thought would be relevant to our audience. I want to talk about working smart versus working hard. Very, very popular entrepreneur that I will not say the name of because I'm actually a fan. But I heard him recently say, you know, people say, are you working smart or are you working hard? And he says, I'm working smart and hard, you know? And I just wanted to clarify that that's actually not possible. At least not simultaneously. So, you know, here's what I mean by that. I had a really interesting conversation today, which is what sparked me wanting to do this. So I was talking to one of our employees who is, she's newer at, you know, getting really difficult projects that require a lot of thought and like figuring things out. Mm-hmm. And I came in, I sat down with her and I was talking to her about this particular problem that needed to be solved that I wanted her to find the solution to. And, you know, I was talking about problem solving and I said, you know, it's interesting. I said, you know, a lot of people that work with me will say things to me like, James, like, man, you're really smart or you're really intuitive and you seem to just figure these problems out. And what I have to remind them and I reminded her is at this morning, I said, you know, do you notice that it's 11 a.m. right now and that I'm just now getting to the office? And she's like, yeah. And I said, what I've been doing for the last 2 hours or so since I dropped my kids off at school is I've been thinking. Because I have a really, really complicated problem right now that I'm trying to solve. And I've spent the last 2.5 hours thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably, and after that meeting, I ended up leaving the building and going back out and went to sit to eat by myself. And I thought for another hour and a half, 2 hours. Well, I've been doing that for about 20 years or so now.
Yeah, as long as I've known you. And
And I've been doing that consistently. You know, my schedule, I definitely have days where I work really hard and I'm back to back to back. I do a lot of days like that. But I also, on my normal average week, I have probably the equivalent of a day or two of like complete time where I have no scheduled appointments. I'm not doing email. I'm not doing meetings. I am thinking. And I am writing down concepts. I'm reading books. I'm reading online resources. I'm researching things. And I'm thinking. Now, that's not for everybody. In other words, you got to know what your strengths are. Maybe your strength is you're the execution person, right? And so to you, taking a day to sit and think about something would be like torturous. You know, it's like, no, I would never do that. Just what do I need to do? And I'll go get it done. You're not the like idea person. You're the, hey, here's the idea, but I know how to execute it. Well, if that's your strength, then you better be a hard worker. Yeah, that's great, right? But I think for a lot of us, we can get trapped in this kind of pseudo productivity, this idea that like, well, today I was really productive because I was really busy.
I pushed all these papers and they're off my desk. So that means I'm productive.
Right. It's like I cleaned out my email inbox. It's like, well, were any of those emails important? You know, most of my really productive days are days where I ignore my email inbox, you know? And so I think there's this idea that can get around, and especially for those that are maybe in more of a work environment, you know, W-2 employee, where you can feel this pressure, and believe me, I feel it as well. This pressure of this person wants to get on my schedule and have a call with me. This person sent me an email. This person is a client and they have a question. And you can have these pressures, which are, you know, there, but you also have to take time for yourself and you have to take time to think about what you're doing. Because to me, the worst case scenario is that you know, climb this ladder your whole life or for 10 or 20 years. You get to the top of the ladder and you realize it was leaning against the wrong building.
There's nothing there.
And you're like, well, what was this all about? Right. So you have to take time to step back and think. And so I think when I, you know, working hard and working smart, I agree with the entrepreneur that I saw who says, you know, I'm working smart and I'm working hard. But I think we have to clarify that we're not doing those things simultaneously. There are going to be times when the value is, hey, I know exactly what I need to do right now. So I just need to get it done. And if that's a stage that you're in, work hard, just work all the time, back to back, schedule yourself out, get it done. But then there's also those times where you're like, you know, I'm not exactly sure what to do. I have this feeling that there's maybe some missing efficiency or some missing kind of productivity that I could, you know, implement here. And so when that is the situation that you're in, then it's time to take a break. And that means a lot of really, really difficult communication, Patty. You know, the number of people that I reach out to or that my assistant now reaches out to on a daily basis that say, thank you so much for reaching out. I'm not interested at this time.
Right.
Sure. I would love to have this conversation with you, but I'm swamped with other projects and I can't.
Right.
I'm choosing not to. Like, you know, that's hard. It's, you know, what's even harder, I think, is when you have to go to your boss and say, hey, there's 4 projects that you've given me to work on. I want to do them really well. And this is the schedule I have planned out to do those 4 projects. This 5th project that you've asked me to take on, I'm not going to be able to do that and do these other 4 really well. So let's talk about what you'd like me to change.
Right. Right.
Are there one of these existing 4 projects you'd like me to stop working on?
Right.
Or would you like to have somebody else work on that 5th project, right? But
right. So it's really like understanding when to work smarter and when to work harder is what you're saying, is understanding.
Yeah. And you got to know your limits.
Yeah.
You got to know your limits. You know what I mean? So I think that's having a lot of difficult communication and understanding that. But I think at the end of the day, for those of you that are, you're the idea person, you're the one running the business, you're the one responsible for strategy.
Right.
If you haven't had a 2-3-4 hour block in the last like week, where you didn't have any meetings, you didn't have any email, and you were just able to sit down and read a book, think about your business, write down on a piece of paper what you needed to do, you are absolutely missing your biggest opportunities, because your biggest opportunities are not going to come to you as you work your way through your meaningless inbox or your social media notifications. They're going to come to you while you're thinking.
Like that, James, it reminds me of the mouse on the spinning wheel, right? That's all you're doing when you're just answering emails and answering calls. You're just spinning your wheels.
Yeah, you're taking what everybody else is sending to you and you're processing it.
Right.
But what are you doing?
Well, you're like, not creating
you,
anything.
Right. Are you doing, is there some new idea you have? Like, what are you doing? That's what matters. And then, as a result of that, sometimes people get upset with me. You know, it's like, oh man, James didn't get back to me. Well, I didn't. I have things that I'm working on that are really important to me. And
there are times, James, you and I work together closely. There are times when I don't hear, I'll put a call in or an email in and I don't hear for a few days. And it's just like, James is busy with other stuff.
He'll get
to me when it gets to me.
And I'll tell you this, one last thing I'll say, and then I'll jump off of my soapbox. But, the only thing I'll tell you, Patty, what's interesting is I was like that before I had the success to justify it. Because
it was part of your success.
I'm going to take time to think about things. I'm going to take time to make strategies that make sense to me. And I don't care if that kind of offends some people or people get upset. Like I'm going to take care of me. I'm going to have some me time and I'm going to make sure that I'm with my family and I'm doing the things that are important to me. And I'm taking time to think about my business. Doing that for me, that was a pillar for my success. You may be different than me, but for me, that's a pillar of my success.
Yeah, so. I can see it. And it's really great advice. Thanks, James.
This is the Insider's Report with Patty Murphy, brought to you by The Green Sheet. For nearly 40 years, The Green Sheet has been the go-to source for news, analysis, and educational tools that empower and connect payments professionals. If you're not reading The Green Sheet already, check it out on the web today at www.greensheet.com.
So James, consumer spending is on a tear. When adjusted for inflation, spending rose by 5.3% in February compared to January. Year over year, adjusted for inflation, February spending was up 2.4%, according to the Commerce Department. Now, analysts are attributing the growth to record employment and salary increases. And the data, what I found it particularly interesting is that this data that just came out, in fact, it just came out this week, is in line with what the National Retail Federation has predicted just a week or two ago. It issued a prediction that retail sales would grow between 2.5% and 3.5% to total between 5.23 trillion and 5.28 trillion this year. When you start talking trillions, my mind just starts getting a little boggled. But NRF said the growth is going to be driven by non-store and online sales, which are expected to grow by 7 and 9% year over year and could total as much as $1.5 trillion. Now, all of this jives with monthly spending data out of Fiserv and another monthly report that was jointly produced by CNBC and NRF. Fiserv, which publishes a monthly small business index, reports that across all sectors, the largest increases in consumer spending were in food service and drinking establishments, followed by professional services and ambulatory care. Let's see, February, I'm joking. I wasn't in an ambulance, but just had to throw that little joke in there,
Right.
But retail also delivered strong results on a large leap in foot traffic in February to produce 3.7% in seasonally adjusted gains over January. Now, the Fiserv Small Business Report aggregates spending activity at small businesses throughout the U.S. The data is derived from POS activity, and it includes cash as well as checks and card sales, online and in person, and across about 2 million small businesses. So it gives us a fairly good perspective. The other thing I thought that was interesting that came out of the Pfizer data was specialty trade contractors. Strong growth in February, month over month, about 2.3%, and about 4.7% over 2023. Now, one last thing I wanted to report on is NRF has teamed up with CNBC to create a new series of spending reports. And recently, the two released their latest. They're calling it the fifth monthly report. I didn't want to do this at first. I wanted to wait for the data to start, you know, coalescing. So based on, it's all based on credit and debit card activity. And in February, according to that report, here's some of the highlights. Online and other card not present transactions were up 0.8% month over month, seasonally adjusted, and 18% year over year unadjusted. Health and personal care establishments saw sales rise 0.96% month over month, 11% year over year. Clothing and accessories, 5.51% month over month, 8% year over year. Grocery and beverage stores were up 0.99% month over month, 5.9% year over year. And if my grocery bill is anything to indicate that, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
And then general merchandise sales saw an increase of about 0.67% monthly, 3.34% year over year. Oh, no, I just think it looks like, you know, I know a lot of people complain about inflation. I'm old enough to remember when inflation was double digits and, you know, we were paying 18% mortgages. So a little bit of inflation, I don't think is that bad. And it certainly is a benefit to generate, you know, to merchants, which, of course, is a benefit to our listeners.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, Patty, thanks for sharing that with us today.
Thank you for listening to the Merchant Sales Podcast. Whether you are an industry veteran, processing executive, or just trying to learn about the payment space, we appreciate your time. The Merchant Sales Podcast is a joint production of GreenSheet.com and CCSalesPro.com. And we hope you will tune in next week for more information and tips on building your merchant services business.